No balls and no balls and no balls. In honor of Ghostbusters, what 80s comedy deserves a reboot?
I'm Matt Patches, and I was going to say Stripes, possibly starring the Broad City Gals, but no, we already have that movie. It's called Zero Motivation. It's an Israeli film. Go see it. So instead, I'm going to say Trading Places for the Bernie era.
I'm Jonah Robinson. I was going to say Weekend at Bernie's with Harry Potter, but we already have Sorry Man. So I'll say Mannequin with a gender-swapped James Marsden and the Kim Cattrall role.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I'm going to say Ferris Bueller's Day Off, but with internet culture. I'm not sure how it'd work, but I would watch it attempted.
And I am David Ehrlich, and I was also going to say Weekend at Bernie's. I may still commit to Weekend at Bernie's or adjust for Weekend at Bernie's 2. Because why not? I think we could always use more movies about people pretending that their not even friend person is alive and getting involved in some sort of like shady heroin deals and their It's a very complicated movie when you revisit.
Keep going, keep going. More.
Weekend at Bernie's 2 has like a voodoo curse. Like Bernie actually like dances around. It's a far superior sequel.
So Swiss Army Man 2.
Yeah, I'd watch it.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fighting in the War Room. It's number 127 for Tuesday, July 12th, 2016. And on this day, in 1804, Alexander Hamilton died. Is that in the Hamilton musical?
It is.
Yes.
No, they
okay.
Included that part.
They included that part? Okay, good. I will now sing my favorite song from Hamilton. You only get one shot. Do not miss your chance to blow. This opportunity comes once in a lifetime. Because it's about one shot.
No.
Yep. No, that's pretty accurate.
That's not the best song from Hamilton?
No. You've got it. And then the other one about how his hat is like a shark's fin.
Sounds as great as you guys have been saying. Hey, we have David back. David, you're back from, you were away from the podcast. You went far away.
I went on a soul searching trip to across the oceans in search of myself and better movies. And I found at least one of those things.
So you were starring in a Sofia Coppola film.
Indeed. Actually, there was a moment or two where I felt as though I was. But
Where were you really?
But is this not going to be a segment? Dare I spoil the surprise?
It's not going to be a segment on today's show. What are you talking about?
I don't know. I don't pay attention to the organ. I thought we had bandied that about.
Jesus.
I was in the Czech Republic in a spa town called Karlovy Vary for the Karlovy Vary Film Festival. It's a wonderful film festival.
You wrote a lot of good things out of there. People can read that. I'd rather get you the traffic on IndieWire.com.
No, thank you. Yeah, look for some reviews. I interviewed Willem Dafoe, and then not yet published at the time of this recording is a very strange profile of Charlie Kaufman. So
there you go.
Look forward to that.
We also have Joanna Robinson.
Hello.
Returning from a vacation, but from a very long vacation from this podcast. It's been a little while.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
But the reviews demanding you back have been pretty steady.
So we made Katie have a baby so she could leave so that I could come hang out for the summer.
Nine months in the making. Joanna's return.
Yeah.
Before we get right into the main episode, we've got one review to read. It's actually an update. That's something you can do. I don't know if that helps our standings in iTunes, and so may defeat the purpose of leaving reviews, but we're going to read the update anyway, because we want to encourage people to actually leave fresh reviews. David?
Indeed. So you can read the full review if you go to our iTunes page and click on sort the reviews by most recent, but I'm just going to read the update by Marcus330, who is an interesting and unique review for us. Updated with a comment from a friend, says Marcus. Update. I'm happy to report that my friend has become a devoted listener. He's chosen to start from the very beginning, excluding Operation Kino, and has now reached deep into the heart of summer 2014 with episode 34. I will share with you some of his thoughts upon listening to 9 months' worth of shows. Patches is my favorite. He's knowledgeable and opinionated without seeming pretentious. Katie Rich and Dave Gonzalez seem a little less knowledgeable, though I feel they may represent the average moviegoer more than Patches or David Ehrlich.
Bah.
I'm still trying to decide if I hate Ehrlich. He's clearly well-informed and has the experience of a working filmmaker, and I really appreciated his takes on The Rover and Blue Ruin. But he can be so overly dismissive of other movies at the same time. He complains about the visual sameness of the Marvel movies, the Marvel films, rather, while praising the techno-vomit that overwhelms the Transformers debacles. Well, at least he does great annual best-of montages. And that is the end of the update. For the full review, go on our iTunes page.
The good news is it only gets better from there.
I look forward to seeing what the friends, how friends' opinions evolve or don't in the next 2 years' worth of episodes they are apparently working their way through.
Well, I hope that when he gets to the end and he hears this reading of the review, that he leaves his own review. Or she. I guess it's not specified, is it?
Can men and women ever really be friends, though? Think about it.
Our podcast defies gender. It defies age. It defies every categorization. You are just a listener, and we are the entertainment, I guess. Anyway, leave a review! It really helps us climb up the charts and beat the Billions podcast. And Joanna's podcasts. Many of them. Right, Joanna? We're competing with you now.
Oh, no, you can't compete with me if I'm one of you. I'm in the fold.
Holy shit. This is getting deeper and deeper. Existential shit.
I neutralized the threat by joining it. So there you
damn
go.
It. Art of War. All right, on with the show.
Sunday, instead of a new episode of Game of Thrones, HBO gave us a whole new series that called Night Of, from writer Richard Price, director Steve Zaillian, and based on a British show called Criminal Justice. It stars Riz Ahmed as Nasir Khan, a hapless young man who gets sort of caught up in these terrible circumstances and ends up being accused of murder. John Turturro stars as his lawyer, and Bill Camp gives a great performance as Dennis Box, this detective. In the original British series, it was Ben Whishaw as the suspect. And yeah, it's a great, I've seen the British version. Anyway, this is getting rave reviews from people. It's got, from critics, it's got a serial vibe that might
critics
suck
aren't
in
people.
that might suck in people. You know, I think it's 9 episodes, and I believe HBO has released 8 to critics and is holding back the last one. Like, nobody has seen the last one.
Well,
so
please, at this point, while we're recording, only the 90-minute pilot has aired, so let's not.
No, I know. I'm just saying HBO believes they have something very special, I think, in the finale. And I believe this sort of air of mystery of, you know, making a murderer or serial or these other true crime or the O.J. Simpson thing. I guess the guilt or innocence of the main character is actually not the most important thing, but they might sort of try to make it feel like that's the most important thing. We might spend the summer True Detective style trying to solve this murder. But you're right, as of recording this, all of us have seen the first 90 minutes, and I loved it. I would love to talk about it with you guys and talk about the original British version and some differences.
I'm disappointed to learn that it's not. I mean, HBO has been in such a fucking free fall in terms of their original content that I was really, given how much I took to the pilot of the show, was hoping that it would represent a step in the right direction. And I feel like it having in my mind while I was watching it been an original show would have been nice and a sort of a sign that things were moving in the right direction. There was some disappointment It won't take away from my enjoyment of the show, just in terms of thinking that the network was getting back on its feet in between all those Ballers ads to learn that it was an adaptation of another show. I did think that it was a pretty phenomenally intriguing. I think HBO pilots are historically, what's the word? Incoherent or overly muddled and convoluted, difficult to get into.
What comes to mind when you say that?
Like every pilot for an hour long they've ever done.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
I don't know. I feel like the shows tend to make you work for it, which is not a bad thing, but and may. The Sopranos is probably the exception that comes to mind, but I feel like Game of Thrones, the first episode of which.
Everyone says it takes like 4 or 5 episodes to get into The Wire. I think that's true.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I've never seen more than the pilot of The Wire because I find the pilot's so boring.
I think True Detective season 1 started really strong out of the gate.
Oh, yeah. I disagree. I think that True Detective, it's not as inaccessible, but I don't think that show really finds its legs for 3 or 4 episodes, and then in hindsight may never have. But The Night Elf looks a lot more my speed. I will say that from what I've seen, and I have not seen any of the British shows, clearly from my preamble, it does not strike me as a did he or did he not do it. If in fact the character did do it, we are dealing with a show that I'm not interested in watching. Because as far as we know so far, given how much time we spent privately with the character, the only explanation I can think of as to how this character could have done it is some sort of disassociative fugue state, which is just so, I'm so sick of. I'm pretty much declaring a fatwa on all stories about memory loss or,
Wait, what comes to mind when you bring that up? What are you talking about?
Like, every psychological thriller ever, when it was like, oh, you selectively forgot such and such an event, and then
well,
you kill them.
Well, my guess is that
I don't
we
think
may
this
never
is that
know.
Kind of story.
We may no, never, but we may he may not be. The truth may never come out. I think what's interesting about this is that there's plenty of doubt. There's reason to think that he could have done it. Reason to think he couldn't have. But the system doesn't necessarily work towards that, as John Turturro says in the first episode, I believe. That we don't talk about the truth. It's not the conversation. The truth will nail you.
See, my hope, and it's completely unfounded because I have no idea where the series is going, is that it's not at all about the crime, and it's much more about the system. They made the key switch of making this character when taking it from Ben Whishaw,
right?
To make him Pakistani. He grows up in Jackson Heights. There are racial elements a poppin' in this pilot.
Well, that's what I want to know from Joanna, because I think part of what I love about this series so far, and I've seen 3 episodes, I won't go into spoiler territory or anything, but it feels very New York or very American. I think you don't have to live in this city to relate to the American justice system, stories from inside giant prisons, stories from people who were kept waiting for their trials in major prison systems, and how scary that could be, or how the police function, how people can be coerced. Even when cops are trying to do their jobs and function, they're not corrupt. They're just doing what they do. And I feel this all feels very grounded. You know, having someone like Richard Price, who's written a lot of crime fiction before, and has
episodes of The Wire.
Yeah, exactly. Having someone, you know, David, you were griping that, oh, it's not original, but I don't know.
I'm just saying that it would be nice for HBO.
Sure,
but I don't think that's necessarily a
reason to damn it. And I also think, speaking to what you were saying about how elegant the pilot is and how thought out this idea seems to be, I know that they were talking about doing it, I think, back in like 2011 or 2012.
They shot this 4 years ago. They shot parts of it 4 years ago.
I don't know.
James
I think they may have reshot the whole thing.
I think it's 2013, I think, is
but
when
they shot – James Gandolfini shot
right.
on this
yes.
show.
He yes. shot the pilot, yeah. Gandolfini was really supposed to be in the lawyer lead in the John Turturro role, and then it was supposed to be Robert De Niro, and then it was John Turturro. I think Turturro is great in it. And it's – I did want to talk a little bit about the adaptation part of it, because this is just leagues better than the British version, and that's not usually the case when it comes to American adaptations. The British version is 6 hours, and this is over 8 hours. They just
written
have a lot
by Peter Moffett, right? Of Doctor Who?
That's a different Moffat.
Oh, Stephen
Moffat.
Wait, yeah. Is Peter Moffat related to Stephen Moffat?
I think he's his brother. I think he's his brother. Okay. I think. Anyway, I rewatched the first episode this afternoon to sort of refresh myself because it had been a while since my obsessive completist Ben Whishaw phase. But it's completely not as good. You 20 minutes in, they discover the murder weapon on his body in the exact same way, but it's only 20 minutes in, and you do not spend this time with Ben Whishaw. And as sort of boyish as Ben Whishaw can be, he does not have that like bunny in a trap sort of vibe that Riz Ahmed has, yeah. where you just watch him make mistake after mistake and every bit of evidence that he drops on the way and the sinking feeling that you have, everything he touches. And then when you see the Chiron flash at the beginning, like 2014, and you're like, oh shit, like that was my sinking feeling, is like, is this going to go from 2014 yes. to 2016, you know? And like,
I love how loaded that is. I love yeah. that, you know, he's just going to be stuck.
He's going to be stuck in this for so long. Yeah, exactly. And yeah. so,
and I mean, it's a real tightrope walk that he has to do in order to make you believe what it is you're saying, that a character could make as many mistakes.
Right.
I think it's a little hokey. I think it has to set up all these parts so that it can keep paying off throughout the series. It's a little hokey. And the girl that he hooks up with at the beginning.
Yeah, so
it all seems a little too perfect.
And the racial stuff is really so interesting, of course, like from not just the Pakistani angle, but like, you know, the other non-white people in the cast. And in the British version, it's all white people except for Ruth Negga actually plays the victim, the girl in the first episode. But other than that, it's like all white people all the time. And Ben Whishaw is like just this sort of laddish soccer guy, and he does things in a like blind panic. He's like crying and panicking, so that's more believable, all the shit that he does in like crying and panicking. But you're so much more invested in this story, I think. So anyway, I don't know if we're like giving too much away of the pilot if people haven't seen it, but it's really compelling. It's almost a movie. It's an hour and a half. It's almost a movie, except you know that it's like, this is only the first chapter in what everyone who's seen all the other episodes, I haven't, but everyone who has seen the episodes that have been released have said it just like maintains, which is not something we can always expect from a show these days. And to David's point about the guilt not mattering, I mean, we just got through obsessing over the People versus O.J. Simpson, which once again was about the criminal justice system and had nothing to do, like it wasn't really about, well, you go into that show already deciding in your mind whether or not O.J. did it. And so it's not about discovering anything. It's about all the vagaries of our broken system. And I think we have real opportunity for that here as well.
Yeah, I mean, this felt like a lot like an episode of Krzysztof Koszalowski's The Decalogue, and how it plays with morality and how the various pieces fall into place. I will, to Patch's point, completely agree that the girl in particular, and I wish I knew her name offhand, it's no fault of her own necessarily, but the character is so out of a movie, out of a romanticized version of the story.
She escaped from a Sundance drum and
manic pixie dream.
Like they want to make it feel like this sort of surreal night that is unlike any experience that's ever happened to this character before. That feels like, you know, she's supposed to feel like she sort of walked into his life from a dream. But they probably pushed that element a little bit.
Maybe she did. It's
too
all a
far.
Dream.
But you know, and it's very promising. I'm definitely hooked. And here I was between Bill Simmons and Ballers, ready to fucking just ban HBO from my life for the rest of the summer. But
and the didn't he is less. I think that is less to do with the show itself and more to do. I was more extrapolating to the larger, what the viewing culture is going to do with it. Like Entertainment Weekly already has a like, did Nas do it sort of article up this week. And so
they have every article. So
Thrillist has, who's that cool guy in the leading role?
People want to know.
Did you know
that Riz Ahmed, he plays like a 23-year-old in the show and he is 33.
Really?
He
was boyish looks.
So good in Nightcrawler, and he's gonna be in Rogue One and the Bourne movie. Like he's gonna pop off.
I'm worried about whoever will play in the Bourne movie. I don't want that to Stereotypical. No, but he's really excellent. That trifecta of John Turturro, who I would be curious what you guys think of the eczema.
In the first episode, it's less of a plot line if it becomes one than it is.
Well,
one
three episodes in,
shot.
And he's mostly just scratching his eczema and going to the doctor occasionally.
I cannot really speak to it yet, out, but it's gross.
It is gross. It's very gross. And then Bill Camp is just.
Well, it's
I
funny.
Don't know. It's so intense. But
I think Bill Camp is great.
I think that he is the heart and soul of the pilot,
absolutely,
at least.
Yeah.
He is, and he's doing a part that has been done many, many, many times before, which is sort of that no-nonsense detective who
listens to opera.
Sort of like, it has like a human core, and it's tough to really suss out when he's being warm to a suspect, if he is just being humane, or if he is digging for answers, or some combination of the two. But he, and I think his hair sells a lot of this.
Yes.
Because he does a really good job of towing that line. And he is the character that I'm most interested in at the moment, especially because I have, you know, and of course, I'm sure this will change over the next 7 episodes. At the moment, I feel as though I've already sort of made up my mind about the main character. Although I do love that his father is played by the star of A Separation, the Iranian film by Asghar Farhadi.
Oh.
So that was an unexpected sort of transplant from one world to the other. And I think sort of it really sort of cements the idea of Jackson Heights and New York City and America as a whole, as this melting pot, as this collision of cultures, and how that is going to be so integral to the season.
I'd say that the biggest change that I've seen, and it's sort of telling to me about what the priorities are in this adaptation, is the Turturro character. And I don't know how much that character would have been the same. I mean, I could see Gandolfini kind of doing that with or without the sandals. I don't know. I could see De Niro doing what Turturro is doing. But in the British version, he's like a leather jacket wearing, fast talking, like, you know, sleazy lawyer who ends up coming to his defense. So it's a huge difference. And then that to me feels more soulfully Richard Pricey, New York-y sort of thing. You sort of see him, John Turturro's character, with this trench coat that's almost like a cape sort of thing, like heavy as the head. Like he's got this burden of like, I feel like there is a right and a wrong, and I see a wrong here, and I want to do something about it, you know? So
the night of, we're going to keep watching it. Who knows if he did it or not? It doesn't matter. The drama matters.
Dave, have you just not your cup of tea?
Too busy Pokemoning.
Wow. Oh, I have thoughts, but we'll be back to them, and they'll be better form than just off 90 minutes, because there are a lot of things that I like, but then I feel like some places I could feel the hand of the narrative forcing me in a direction, and that could be cool if it pays off in a narrative way, but really lame if there's like a moment where John Turturro turns around and decides to represent the kid without talking to him in every episode, you know? But to be continued.
You've shown great restraint in this conversation by not throwing judgment after 90 minutes, just like The Night Of. Dave, why are the people milling about outside your apartment right now like it's the night of the living dead?
Oh, you know, I live across from a Pokemon Go gym. In case you haven't heard.
Go on.
There's a new top app in town, and it's called Pokemon Go. It is a location-based app. You catch Pokemon in the real world. There's an AR overlay, an augmented reality overlay, if you would like it, so that you are actually catching the Pokemon in the environment, or you could turn that off and just keep looking down at your phone. But you do have to be in geographically specific places to get power-ups like Pokeballs and revive potions, or to use your Pokemon to battle other people's Pokemon at places called gyms, which are hubs that can be controlled by teams.
So what's the, if you battle somebody, I understand how it works in the game, in the old, the original, like, Pokemon story, but in this
Red, blue.
Game, if you battle someone else's Pokemon, you get to keep them?
No. So this game, you go to a geographic point called a gym, and you claim the gym for your team, and then you could either go and battle for XP that doesn't cause your Pokemon to faint at friendly gyms, or you could go to your competitors' gyms and fight off their Pokemon. If you beat all the competitors' gyms, then you get to leave one of your Pokemon behind to protect that gym for your team.
I already regret asking.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so you've been playing it. How much have you been getting out of the house? How much running around have you done? You know, I think there's been videos that have gone viral this in the last 48 hours that have shown hordes of kids and adults mulling about in the parks, in the parking lots of buildings, trying to get Pokemon. And it really does look like something apocalyptic. Like, you just don't see people gathering together like this in the middle of nowhere. And I'm trying to figure out if it's a positive thing or a negative thing, or if it's forced perspective. If people are, you know, tight frames of their iPhone capturing these people acting like crazy people, or if it's really, it seems to be taking off.
Well, I mean, I imagine it's different.
It seems to be taking off is a huge understatement, right? Like, isn't this the biggest app growth ever? Like,
yeah, I think it, like, it's over. I think at this point it's probably overtaken on Android phones, Twitter, in terms of daily active users. I think that's what Forbes was saying. It's pretty big, and but it's interesting. A lot of it's centered around city centers and public spaces. It's sort of based on this game called Ingress, which is what the company used to run, and they sort of took a lot of the features of that, but just sort of skinned it with Pokemon, and they used the same bases from the Google Maps Ingress data. So in that sense, it's the only thing that's different about this is how popular it is. It really is sort of centered around city centers. You have like the weird outlier stories, like the woman or the girl in Wyoming who found a body because she was like going to a Pokestop.
Dead body. Let's just.
Or the guy in, there was a guy in Massachusetts whose house became a gym because he lived in an old church and the maps auto selected his home.
And people who are rushing into the Holocaust Museum and the people who are finding Pokemon at the World Trade Center Memorial and the people who took that incredible photo of the Pokemon on the riot cops in Baton Rouge. It doesn't seem like the Pokemon coders or whomever is doing this are discriminating between where Pokemon can be.
True augmented reality, you need to let people roam everywhere.
Is like at the peak in the future in the sense that these are public spaces and AR games are new and now a thing. So
we've ripped open the can of worms here.
If you're like a real world AR gamer, like everyone's going to the Holocaust Museum because it's like has to be a public place. You don't want to like screw with people's residences, but not everybody's playing Pokemon. What's cool about this moment right now is
everyone's going to the Holocaust Museum.
No, what I'm saying is that
didn't you get your field trip slip signed? Come on.
If you're talking about a geocaching game, public spaces are always going to be prime locations to put group activities because they're public spaces, and until laws are made, they're not going to be, you know, cause trouble like businesses or people's houses are. So eventually there are going to be other AR games and they're going to start overlaying these public spaces. So it's like you're going to see a whole bunch of people looking down your phone. It'll be just like when iPhone was first released and it was kind of weird to go somewhere and see everybody looking down at their iPhone. What's cool about this moment in time in like the history of AR games is everybody's playing this one game. So if I'm walking across, you know, or if I live across from a gym, so if I'm on my balcony and I see a group of people, you know, pull up in a car at midnight and there are four people in the back, you know, with screens open and I recognize like the gym screen, I know that they're, you know, taking a gym and I'm kind of like watching it happen, whether or not I'm playing. And then I've like met people in the park and you just sort of give like a knowing nod. my like bartender is now interested in Pokemon because she's slightly younger than me and therefore is like more in the key demographic than I am.
So,
but like 20, 24 to 27 year olds are crawling all over Denver.
Can I bring up a couple things that I can't tell if they're silly or not? Number one is like a big article, you know, this particular phenomenon happens to coincide with a lot of protests that have been happening this weekend, you know, in response to police brutality and Black Lives Matter and all of that. And one article I saw circulating a lot was like, Pokemon Go is not safe if you're a Black person. Like, if you're wandering around the park in the middle of the night, you know, police might suspect you of certain activity. And whether or not that was histrionic or not, like, I mean, certainly a lot of evidence would say a lot of things are not safe if you're a Black person in this country. But I thought that was just like an interesting overlap of those two things. And then there's something we talked about off air, which is that this app is highlighting something that's been true of game apps for a long time, which is that game apps have access to your personal data on your phone if you download it, depending to varying degrees. And then the third thing is this all makes me think of that Star Trek Next Generation episode called The Game, where everyone becomes addicted to a game and it's a form of mind control. And that's my like Black Mirror technophobic response to so many people becoming so quickly obsessed with something.
I don't know why I thought about The Matrix this weekend, as if this was like the step before
we
get
plugged in. Or
The
Riddler in Batman Forever. Right. But I think, Joanna, the first thing you mentioned is most interesting for me in this particular week. Of course, what you're saying about, you know, being safe and Black has much deeper ramifications and implications, but the whole idea of these augmented reality things is that they cannot exist in a vacuum, that they overlap with not just the physical spaces in the real world, but all of the social and anthropological baggage that comes along with that.
Right.
And so they're effectively inextricable. And that is, I think that Pokemon Go, which is a very, very, very rudimentary version of this technology, which is going to become more and more advanced as years go on, and will make this look laughable if it doesn't already, is all of the thinking that is going to produce, all the possibilities that can come from it. I think that Pokemon Go does not, I find nothing interesting about it itself, but you love
the disruption.
No, not that word, but I do think that it definitely opens a really interesting door
There's a fourth problem I forgot to mention, which is I guess cops were cautioning against criminals. I don't know. Criminals is such a weird word. People luring people to Pokemon locations and then like jumping them.
Yeah, any game that has a lure feature seems like a huge red flag.
No. These are all the weird thing about Pokemon Go and that like all these stories that portray it, you know, about like, you know, not being able to go to certain parts, depending on what like race you are all like city specific problems. But the weird thing that I've noticed is somebody that lived in New York and like, you know, did like the Dark Knight viral hunt and shit and then moved to Denver and now I'm living through Pokemon Go is really, it's like it's middle America finally has all these like urban problems forced upon it, which is like, people are suddenly getting around in groups and you're seeing all these things like the, you know, luring people like who are obviously using their cell phones and robbing them is like something that we had to deal with in Brooklyn. Like when the iPhone came out, they were like, you know, change the color of your headphones because they're targeting people with, you know, like white headphones. Or then like the idea that there are certain parks that you can't go to at certain times of day is probably a foreign idea to a lot of people in a lot of places. And now this is sort of bringing that to light. So I don't necessarily see it as like a problem with the game. I think it's just everybody adapting
up,
to this
Midwest.
New world that we live in.
It's time for you to feel the pain.
Come on, sheeple.
Well, I don't think it's like a problem of the game in particular. I mean, whatever new technology there is, whatever new thing is happening, there will be people waiting to, you know, use it maliciously.
Yeah, it's
right.
Disruption.
It's not like, yeah, it's not implicit to the game. But I think the particular ways and places in which it happens, exactly as Dave was saying, are what's going to be interesting. It's not like a like ban Pokemon because people are, you know, luring people, because they're just going to come along with something else that does the same thing.
And like, I think there is a part of, I mean, I know nothing about Pokemon. I have not downloaded this app, but like, there's a part of this that is so cool. Like, I did not do whatever Dark Knight thing Dave was talking about in New York, but I did do this like weird haystack scavenger hunt thing in New York when I lived there. And there were just teams running all around the city. And it was so fun. And it's so fun to just like run into a group and know that you're both doing the same thing and then run away across somewhere else across the city. And like, that's delightful. I could see this going south in a million different ways, but that's because I'm old and like angry, but I also see the joy of it.
Of us played Pokemon Go 15, 20 years ago in Boy Scouts when it was called orienteering and our phone was a compass, okay?
That is a completely different thing unless you are keeping wild animals against their will and fighting them against
Here's the real question to wrap this up. Is augmented reality the VHS to virtual reality's Betamax?
No.
Okay.
No, here's why. Because stuff like Microsoft HoloLens is gathering data from the inside of your home, and AR is making you go outside and publicly use data, and I'm a lot less scared about that than I am about, like, when I see videos of an AR C-3PO and an R2-D2 rolls up and projects something on a table. I'm like, how the fuck did he know that was a table? And is he sending that information anywhere? If it's outside my home, I'm kind of okay with it.
You know what this reminds me of? I know you said we were going to wrap it up, but you know, this reminds me of, like, people are extolling the virtues of the physical aspect of this, and I think that's always a good thing when it comes to something that's often sedentary, but, like, do you remember, like, when the Wii came out, and everyone's like, oh, video games are now, like, so exercise! Yeah. And then they weren't. Like, I wonder if, you know, AR is going to be, like, eventually, like, this is how we get the floating chairs from WALL-E or something like that. Like, this is the step. I don't know.
At some point, it'll, like, it'll stop being this, like, basically, this is the most one of the most popular game properties ever. But at some point, this technology will lead to like the sleep no more of across the U.S. and it's going to be great.
Is it?
I just want to
end that. Good question.
I just want to end by saying that because we're talking about the Jewish Museum, I looked up to see if there were any Jewish Pokemon, and I forgot that in 2000, Uri Geller, that Israeli psychic who bends spoons, sued Nintendo over the Pokemon Kadabra, who had a star on his forehead and a spoon in his hand, because he thought that was an infringement and that he was portraying Jewish stereotypes as well as emulating him.
Hasn't he seen the star on the cover of the Frozen coloring book? Come on.
Oh, yeah.
It's innocuous.
Conspiracies!
So, there's a new movie coming out this week. Well, I use new in
fuck you
scare quotes.
Scare quotes.
This movie, for all intents and purposes, came out the year that I was born. But it is called Ghostbusters, and you may have heard of it because some people, and I also use people in finger quotes, scare quotes, are not super psyched about it, and they have great reasons. Let me tell you, the film is called Ghostbusters, which incidentally is the same title as
a horror movie from 1984.
Sure. And horror, I don't know. What's horror anyway?
No, it's horror, and it's my childhood, and you will treat it with respect.
And it was a movie that was shot in New York. And it was called Ghostbusters, and it was about four men who busted ghosts. And now there are people who are upset that the new movie is about four women busting ghosts. Because women, as we all well know, can't really bust ghosts. But in the movies, anything can happen. And so the misogynists of the world are very upset about it. They've been claiming for more than a year now that even before there was any traces of footage to speak of, that no, it's not because we hate women and are weird like cave dwelling man children, who I it's really difficult for me to even tap into why this is such a problem for them, but they have their reasons.
What they say, they say that the trailer isn't funny. That's
well, they eventually,
but they were so mad before the trailer.
Yes,
they were
they
mad
eventually used
before
every bit of information and as ammunition to wrap into their insane narrative. But yeah, this is going full steam. I think my personal hypothesis is that this is a different manifestation of the same psychosis that leads to DC fans being rabid and critics and I mean for every property in this day and age, because of the tools we have to express ourselves and group together into sort of channel our basest worst instincts, all of these brands, which sort of function as lightning rods to sort of behavior these days, attract these loonies. They move in packs, they speak in strange
tongues.
Rhetoric, and Ghostbusters is the latest
that...
target of their ire, because the misogyny is,
look,
is, well, anyway, I'm just setting
as,
it up, so.
No, as the token lady, can I just
please
say something, which is that,
you're not a token lady.
What is true about this is, I'm sure there are plenty of people who are just upset that there's a Ghostbusters reboot, if you want to call it a reboot, whatever, at all. I mean, I would probably be in that camp where they're not so loaded with this misogyny, but like reboots or remakes in general, I've been over for a long time. I hated Jurassic World. I hate a lot of the, like, you know, I hate the concept of a Blade Runner. I hate all this stuff. And so, like, you know, if
both
it were Ghostbusters,
sequels, not reboots.
If Ghostbusters were either with the original cast, as, you know, Dan Aykroyd originally wanted, or with a bunch of dudes, I would probably be on the camp of, we don't need this at all. But given that it's not just because it's ladies that I support it, like, there is a kind of a reboot or remake, like 21 Jump Street, like whatever Lord and Miller do with properties, that is possible in a rebooted franchise. And anything that, Paul Feig and these women do, I am interested in. So it's complicated. It's not just, I mean, I know you know this, but it's not just that, like, if you are not excited about this movie, you're a misogynist, but it's too, it's like Gamergate. It's just, like, too enmeshed.
Well, it's
that,
all
like,
about,
you know,
varying degrees. You know, I think I'm not excited about this movie because I like cinema to move forward.
Right.
And, you know, and people not to simply rehash old ideas. And when they do, they should shoot in motherfucking New York. Anyway. But, you know, my lack of enthusiasm is tempered by sanity, I like to think. And the fact that it was swapping genders and in part, not that women didn't exist in 1984, but there's no doubt that, insisting that this be led by four women does not make some sort of commentary on where we are as a culture right now. That's exciting to me. That's the only upside for why I was enthusiastic for this movie to begin with. And it turns out to be the only reason to see this movie when all is said and done. But the,
we'll get there.
But so these people are very angry and, they are, you know, it is, yes, exactly as Joanna is saying, not all people who don't want to see Ghostbusters are misogynists, but
hashtag not all people.
Not all people, but, I don't think that we need to waste time for anyone who's been on the internet recently, pointing out that there are a large swath of people who
we don't
are
need to
bending over backwards to mask the misogyny that is keeping them from.
Yeah, I think we can all agree there's something deeply ingrained in that. But I do wonder, as a thought experiment, to psychoanalyze it a bit. I want to know if you guys have ever felt that or see this impulse in yourself about anything that you love film property wise. And David, I don't know if you would include yourself in this, but I surely think that Dave and Joanna may feel this way about the properties we love, be it movies or maybe books, TV shows, anything like that, where you start to feel this like trollish swell, like, get off my lawn. Give me back
rage.
The things that I love. The rage. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm ready. I'm ready to unleash my inner troll. Two things. One, I mean, Jurassic World, though I was cautiously optimistic about Jurassic World until I saw the trailer. But I love Jurassic Park, and I hated that whole debacle. And then number two, this is my snootier answer, is like almost anything that has to do with Jane Austen. Oh, that's too broad. Because, like, you know, Clueless is great, and like...
Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
No, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies needs to die in a fire. Bride and Prejudice is good.
Bride and Prejudice is wonderful.
Yeah, Bride and Prejudice is good, but like a lot of, like, Lost in Austen or Austenland, and there's just all this stuff that I think fundamentally misunderstands what is great about Jane Austen, and these just like stupid things that are like, if we put someone named Mr. Darcy in this, people will come see it. And it's that kind of lazy stuff that, like, you know, that recycling of branding that I really, really hate. You know, Curtis Sittenfeld has a new novel out that's based on an Austen property. And it's just like, I just want everyone to let go of Jane Austen. Like, move on. She's wonderful. I love her. She's a genius. But 90% of the adaptations get her wrong, and it drives me crazy. I hope Java's listening to this, because I think she'll agree with me.
I'm realizing that Bridget Jones, the series, has a Darcy in it.
It does. I mean, but that sort of, but that plays with the Mr. Darcy. I mean, especially when they cast Colin Firth as Mr. Darcy in the films, like,
yeah,
that plays with the
shit.
Yeah, but that's like a satellite enough that it doesn't bother me. I am the ultimate arbiter, apparently, of what's okay to touch Jane Austen and what's not.
Well, that's why I'm curious, because these movies are obviously made from a passion for Jane Austen. What is it?
Are they?
They seem to infringe. Well, I don't know.
There's this great, I mean, this is, I really, I'm about to launch into snooty stratosphere, but there's a great video essay by Fran Lebowitz, where she talks about how many people get Jane Austen wrong, and how they read her, it's an immature reading, I think is what she calls it, a girlish, immature reading of Jane Austen as the ultimate rom-com, when then that's not what Jane Austen really was, or that's a surface reading that doesn't really get to what it is. And that's what I think a lot of these, you know, reinterpretations don't get, what makes Jane Austen great. And like I said, I'm sitting over here as if I'm the final arbiter of what is and what isn't great Austen. But I would say Bride and Prejudice is. Pride and Prejudice and Zombies is garbage. And I hate that it existed in any way. So.
Wait, Fran Lebowitz does video essays? Are they on her Vimeo page?
I think she Snapchatted it, you know.
I've looked it up now. It's on the Morgan Library's website. I don't know if video essay is
I'm sorry, an interview. Yes. Sorry, an interview, I guess.
But she does seem to be unleashing in the screen cap.
Yeah.
So Austen movies, those will piss you off. You'll almost comment on Reddit. You'll almost say that they're destroying your childhood.
I would say that they are destroying my childhood. I was telling someone that I actually met a guy who clutched his chest and told me that Ghostbusters was really important to his childhood. Like, a human being in real life told me that. I was like, you are a Reddit comment thread,
but
like,
then
come to
Ghostbusters
life.
Ghostbusters can be important to your childhood just like anything else, but that doesn't mean that, you know, there's a photo that went around this week of two young girls dressed as Ghostbusters at the Ghostbusters premiere, talking to Kristen Wiig.
Yeah.
And people were saying, like, look at these childhoods. They're more important than yours. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. The idea that, like, whatever they do to this property, whatever the, and whatever, like, facsimile they make of it, you still have, I mean, this is an argument as old as remakes themselves, but you still have the original. It's not, that notion isn't perverted in some way simply because it's made accessible to a new generation or type of person.
Why doesn't that hold weight with people? Why doesn't you have the original seem to
because
stick?
They feel like, I mean, I'm projecting.
Please,
here
put
I'm
words
doing
in
my
mouth.
Best guess, but like I feel like they feel like they are stewards of this property, that they are they have this sort of bond with it. It is like when you go home after the first time you've gone to college and you feel like a tourist in your own hometown and everything's changed. And it's, I don't know. I just feel like it's like you made a pact with this thing and you and it were buddies. And then suddenly it changed. It grew up. You no longer recognize one another.
Are they the tea party of an old version, an archaic version of this?
Well,
political faction, this religion that is Ghostbusters?
From my point of view, I guess, I'll keep it to Jurassic Park levels because that is more relatable than my weird Jane Austen shit. But like that, it bothers me that there are kids who are going to grow up and see Jurassic World first instead of Jurassic Park. And like, you know, the same could be said of like the two crappy sequels that happen after Jurassic Park. But like that Jurassic Park exists, in my opinion, as a perfect film. And I would love that to be the shining beacon of the Jurassic franchise. And like, no, my copies of Jurassic Park did not burn up and disappear and go away when Jurassic World came out, but it does sort of tarnish it somehow. And I don't feel that way about Ghostbusters. Not that Ghostbusters wasn't important to me. I watched both it and the sequel, which I weirdly liked as a kid. And now I'm a million times like I'm here for the Statue of Liberty dancing. Like I am here for that. But like,
the emotion slime is really coming out again.
the toasters in my house are dancing. Anyway, I've talked too much about this. I should probably stop.
Well, Dave, what about you? I feel like you've been pushed to the edge.
I'm the rational one in this argument because I've loved a lot of things that have been perverted beyond. I mean, that's like sort of how I feel is when this happens to you for the first time or with like something that's really core to you, it's like crushing because what's the actual fear is that you're not going to get more of what you like. And for some people, if Ghostbusters is your thing, like your actual thing, I'm going to try to be your advocate here. You got like all this talk about Ghostbusters 3 for like years that never happened. And then all of a sudden you got this video game that Harold Ramis and Dan Aykroyd wrote and the cast came back and did the voices and everybody was interested in Ghostbusters. Then there was a few years where it might look like something would happen. And then Harold Ramis dies and it's like no more. And then not only is it no more, but in an attempt to sell things to you, because young people don't buy anything, as an advertiser once told me, they, you know, completely change everything that you thought you were going to get more of for a few years there into something that definitely says, here's the new normal. You're not going to get more of what you like. That's like the great fear. The sad thing is that I was a kid who was in love with serialized storytelling or just things told in installments to begin with. So I went with this through this probably by being a fan of the clone saga in Spider-Man, which is universally reviled, but because I was a child and that's when I was getting into Spider-Man, that's when I like it. It's bad. I still really like it. I get really pissed off when people, you know, get mad about it. And then the other one was Godzilla, where I like grew up watching his, you know, various movies with my friend. And then in 1998, it's like, oh, great. There's going to be an American one using like awesome American technology and it's going to be fun. It's going to be great. And then that happened. And
wait,
Where did Spider-Man get screwed up?
Yeah.
Well, see, the weird thing is that if you like the clone saga, but you're like,
is that the one where he goes to Mars? Did he go to Mars?
No. Well, okay, never mind. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that has happened that has made me almost give up on Spider-Man, but because my initial love was so different from what other people liked, every time Spider-Man becomes a new thing, it's almost guaranteed not going to be the thing that I want more of. And so that's what caused like the great pain of, you know, everybody unwriting the clone saga and Ben Reilly becoming like this punchline as a shitty Spider-Man. Same thing with Godzilla. I, you know, had a preview ticket to that movie and I had to live with it for a long time until Gareth Edwards came and at least delivered something that was recognizable to me. But for a while, 1998, like, poisoned it so much, it's like, well, there's not going to be any more Godzillas. You're going to maybe get some DVD releases of some old movies you didn't have before, but that's based on DVD technology. The Godzilla pool has been poisoned. No more of what you love. And that's the fear.
I think the biggest like version of this in our culture has to be Star Wars, right? Where we had three Star Wars movies. Then we have three Star Wars movies that are hated by so many people. But I had talked to some young people who were kids when the prequels came out and think that they're superior because they were kids when they came out and they just appeal to them. And then you come back around to The Force Awakens. Like you would think after the three prequels that I would say, no more Star Wars, please leave it alone. Please, you've done enough. But I was excited for The Force Awakens. And I love The Force Awakens. So I don't know. I guess these things are just cyclical and we'd all be a lot more mentally healthy if we unclenched. I think you guys are all a lot more zen about this than I am generally. So
yeah. I mean,
go ahead, David.
No,
Okay. There's something different with like the Jane Austen we were talking about. There are certain subjects that are going to be, you know, like echoed in this cyclical thing, like whatever we're talking about. We're going through a time period right now where, like I said, this is my opinion, but they're having trouble selling media across multiple right. quadrants. And one of the solutions seems to be take something from the 80s or the early 90s and spin it out to like new people and these people at the same time. I think that's going to pass, but like, I think we're always going to have like new Austins, new Sherlock Holmeses, new Draculas, you know, these like big arch narratives will keep coming through. I don't think Ghostbusters is one of those because it didn't have enough media to define what that trope is.
Although like, Sony did say that, and this is their choice of words, endless. That Ghostbusters would be endless. And I can confirm, having seen the new one, already true.
I don't want to go to bat for Ghostbusters yet, but god damn it. It is good.
I think that they are, you know, brands are life, man. Like, that's in the modern box office. That's
yeah, but like brands and nostalgia don't.
That was like
to
a deep cut
really
Good Will
work.
Hunting reference, by the way.
I got you. Yeah.
Thank you.
It comes naturally too. That's the movie. What if they remade Good Will Hunting? Would you be?
But I do think that, and this is a whole different conversation. That Jane Austen is bigger than Dracula. And of course, Dracula bigger than Ghostbusters on this totem pole here. Jane Austen is like a form of storytelling. It is a
it's like an text sort of thing. Yeah,
and Dracula is, you know, obviously a formative character, and there's a lot of gothic tropes that come along with him. But Jane Austen is a universe. Dracula is a
Jane Austen
planet.
Also seems like a fundamental it's part of formative years for so many young women, especially at least the ones that I grew up around. I don't know, Joanna.
I mean, let me clutch my chest.
Actually part of childhood.
Let me clutch my chest and tell you that Jane Austen was very informative to me growing up.
I'm trying to think of they're making a Ghost in the Shell movie next year.
I wrote this down to ask you about it, because that's the only thing I could think of that you might love.
Right, and there was talk at one point about, I'm bringing up like all three of the animes that I care about, but like there was always talk about making Cowboy Bebop at one point with Keanu Reeves in the lead role. There is ongoing talk of making an Akira movie. I don't really have any special. Well, I do like Akira. I think Akira is really interesting. But anyway, The Ghost in the Shell is first and foremost in my mind because that is happening. It is already in production. We have seen the photos of Scarlett Johansson in already a racial quagmire playing a historically Asian character, and all of Ghost in the Shell is, I would argue, fundamentally sort of inextricable from Japanese culture. So whitewashing it, there's a lot of problems. But that is something that I'm already concerned about. My expectations are in the gutter. I think that, I don't know. That's like, I'm just trying to engage with this topic on like the level of things that I care about that could result in really shitty movies. And like, yeah, maybe it'll be a few minutes of me going like, hey, the Ghost in the Shell. Ghost in the Shell movie was never very good. Even the original, groundbreaking as it was,
Standalone Complex.
Yeah, but like Standalone Complex is an incredible television show. And yeah, maybe it makes it that much harder to sell people on this one idea that they were already going to be resistant to because it's anime. But I can live with that. I don't know. It doesn't like take anything away from me.
I'm not saying we are normal, but I am saying we have kind of lucked out not being so attached to the things that we love. I mean, we love movies, we love pop culture, we love television, but we're not, none of us seem that, I don't know, we don't embrace it so
I wonder if
you're asking, like, what makes people, like, so angry they'll, like, actually
do
something.
Yeah, well, I look deep in myself. My examples would be something like The Last Airbender. People know that we did an Avatar core podcast, Public City Dispatch. I mean, we're pretty dedicated to that universe, to use terminology that fandom might respond to. And yet, I mean, I watched M. Night Shyamalan have his way with the first season of Last Airbender. It's horrific. It's a real mess. From someone who thought they were being extremely reverent and preserving it, I suppose, it's a disaster. and it tore me apart. I just wanted to see those movies realized. You know, when you hear someone spend a year hyping a movie that they're making is like live action Miyazaki, you want to see that. You want to see that so badly. And it just ripped apart. It's horrible.
Cover songs is a fitting analogy at all, because I can imagine how, like, if let's say you're a big Leonard Cohen fan and then Jeff Buckley comes along and recovers Hallelujah, and then it's his, to Joanna's point. Yeah. It becomes his, and that's how people engage with it. And then people forget that in a way that they wouldn't with Jurassic World, that, right. You know,
do people ever really forget? Really?
I think a lot of people, don't know, especially like 5 or 10 years ago when Jeff Buckley's Hallelujah cover was everywhere, and people our age are really discovering it. They don't know that it was originally not his song. And
it feels really easy to produce a cover song, and some might be hits, but someone else will do, I mean, thousands of those of him that has been produced and reproduced, and but a movie remake feels like a huge investment. Like,
I see.
There's $150 million. We're going to put it on the line. And if it fails, like The Last Airbender is a perfect example. I wanted to see all three of those movies. And I thought the first one sucked. So, but I knew that I wasn't going to get any more. And I actually feel the same way about the upcoming The Dark Tower movies that they're currently making that Idris Elba's in. I love those books. Talking about books I was reading, you know, when I was a teenager into my 20s into college. Like, I just love that series.
Did you ever finish them?
Yeah.
There was
a huge gap because he almost died.
And then he kept going.
But,
yes, he did it for us.
But the, you know, the good analogy, another good analogy there is I loved the His Dark Materials books. I did not mind. Perfect. I didn't mind the Golden Compass movie as much as some people, but it was so unpopular that they just, like, bombed that whole franchise. And now the BBC is making an adaptation, which I imagine is going to hew more closely to sort of like the Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell adaptation that they made last year, which was great. Like, there's another chance for this adaptation to live.
Can it be the same? So now they have to scale it down. I mean, which could work for some aspects of the book. Some parts of
I'm worried about
too big.
About the, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I don't think you need Nicole Kidman in it. Like that
she
bigness, she was good, but you don't need her. There is some like CG, there are some CG concerns I have as ever, but like, you know, that's an example. Or like, I just read all of Neil Gaiman's Sandman, and I know that Joseph Gordon-Levitt wanted to get a Sandman thing off the ground, and then he like, it's one of a million times that they've tried to make that property. They ditched it. And then I'm kind of glad. That's a thing that I don't want adapted because I don't think it can be done. So I don't know.
I'm worried about Dark Tower because Dark Tower, they're condensing so much. They're playing around with it, which is smart. Don't adapt the books. Find innovative ways to like sidequel or be a sequel in the first place, I hope. But I still want all the movies and all the stories from the books. I just want to see them on screen. I don't, if it bombs, which there's a definite possibility it will bomb, I'll get nothing and I'll be very upset, but not so upset that when they remake it with a Lady Roland in 20 years that I would complain. Well, guys who are angry about Ghostbusters, we don't really get you.
No. That's not true. I will say this. I looked into the idea of maybe reclaiming some of my Ghostbusters toys and discovered them to be from my parents' house, and discovered them to be severely played with. And so, out of curiosity, I went on eBay just to see how many usable Ghostbusters toys are still floating around, and not that many. Because sliming was a big deal, because we were little kids and it was Saturday morning cartoons while they were pushing toys at the same time was a big deal. And people played with the shit out of these
anyway,
things.
Anyway, just because the misogynist Ghostbusters movie
Penis.
Fans happen to be right this time does not... Well, no,
they're
it doesn't mean
right.
That they were right. Just because they happen to be... They're correct. Their predictions about the movie not being good happen to come true.
You
not
are,
that they
you, are
right.
You stand in that on that side of the line. Not all of us.
It's
do.
A terrible movie, but
it
they're
is
still
a very good
terrible.
Movie.
They're even worse people.
Not all Fitware podcasters agree with you. I've seen it get mostly like tepid reviews, or like B+ reviews. I've seen some negative, though. David apparently didn't like it. Richard Lawson of Vanity Fair did not like it. So, you know. I think both of you were really rooting for it to be good. I genuinely think that both of you wanted it to be good.
We are going to see more than one movie this year where the world is a better place for it existing in theory. And you desperately want it to be good. And you just cannot, as a critic who has nothing more than their integrity to their name, you just cannot vouch for it. It is very, very frustrating.
But I just want to say there are no soft passes from the four of us.
I want everyone out there to listen to our review episode in bad faith and just assume that anyone who likes this movie is doing so for all the wrong reasons, because they are. I'm kidding.
Boo. I'm a ghost. And that does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back at the end of the week with a review of Ghostbusters, a great film. No, it's just a very good film, and according to David, the horrible. But we'll be talking to you later. In the meantime, why don't we tell people who we are, where they can find us.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spell my first name D-A-7-E. That is also my Twitter handle. I write at latino-review.com and geek.com. You can also find all of our back podcasts and a place to comment with a comment active community at fightinginthewarroom.com, our website. It also, if you go really poking around, has a multi-part AV episode by episode breakdown of Lost and its plot. You know, just a reminder, that's there.
I am David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic at IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of my coverage of the briefly alluded to Carlo Avivari International Film Festival on IndieWire. And you can find all of us together, not talking about Carlo Avivari, but talking about other stuff. Talking about you on Facebook, Fighting in the War.
Oh, you should pimp your IndieWire podcast appearance, because I wanted you to talk about Garastami, but you said, no, I already did that on the IndieWire podcast.
Yes,
nailed it.
I was roped. That's exactly what I fear that I sound like and why I don't listen to this podcast. But I was roped into doing the IndieWire podcast where I work with Eric Cohn, and we had a lovely chat about, it's called Screen Talk. You can find it on IndieWire, you can find it on iTunes. We talked about the death of the late, great Abbas Kiarostami, whose death really upset me because he is a titan of cinema in Close Up, which is a film that he made.
And they recast him as a woman.
Yes, exactly. Close Up is, for my money, the best film ever made. And
on Hulu.
Its maker is no longer with us, and that is upsetting. And you can listen to me talk about that, talk about Carlo Avivari, Screen Talk.
I'm Jonah Robinson. You can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at JoeWroteThis. And if you want to hear more pop culture chatter from us, our Game of Thrones podcast, Storm of Spoilers, is doing a tour of various pop culture oddities this year. And this week we're doing Harry Potter. Next week we will be busting ghosts. And we'll keep you updated on our subject matter as the year progresses.
Destruction of childhood. and I am Matt Patches. I am on Twitter, Mr. Patches, and we are on Twitter at FITWR. You can send us, you know, thoughts about the episode. We'll probably retweet whatever you got. It's always fun to share what people are talking about. I also love when people at message their friends on Twitter and say, hey, why are you not listening to at Fitwer?
Do
great
love
thing
that
to do. Yes, I'll definitely favor that. And on Twitter, you can also answer this week's lightning round question, which is,
in honor of Ghostbusters, what 80s comedy deserves a reboot?
That's it for now. We'll be back later this week. Bye-bye.